Mark Lehner, I assume. Or do you say Lehner?
No, Lehner.
Okay, that's what I remembered, but I... you don't remember, but we have actually talked before. I interviewed you, I think, in person in Wisconsin in probably 96, right after Tooth Imprints on a Corn Dog came out.
Hmm.
You were only interviewed by several hundred people. I don't know why you don't just leap up and say, well, of course I remember.
No, your name sounded very familiar to me. I remember this.
Good.
I remember this wonderful place I used to stay in Madison.
Oh.
It was a bookstore.
Ah, yes, Canterbury.
That had a theme.
Yes.
Oh, like Canterbury Tales theme.
Yep, that's right.
Yep.
Yes, the inn is still there. The bookstore has changed hands several times and now is, I think, on the verge of becoming a store called A Room of One's Own.
Mm-hmm.
But it's good. They're still selling books.
Yeah, well, that's unusual.
It's a positive these days.
that's right.
Although I did notice that the Sugar Frosted Nutsack comes out as a Kindle book.
Yes.
How you could not be in the market today without doing that, could you?
I imagine not, you know. It's not. It's out of my hands. I mean, that's a
sure.
publisher's decision. But,
yeah.
I mean, I'm sort of on the fence about it, personally.
Yeah.
I have a Kindle.
Yes, I do too. So I'm
and
not.
I kind of enjoy it. But I'm much more content to have a book in my hand than a Kindle in my hand.
I agree. I love, however, being able to travel with a library.
Yeah, it's also good if you're next to someone who's sleeping.
Yes.
Can read and not put a light on. There's some practical. You can't wrap a fish in it, though. Or
no.
Swat a mosquito with it.
Well, you could.
You could.
But
it would be an expensive kill.
It would.
So you'd have to really hate that mosquito.
That's true. And sometimes... Sometimes one does. I want to ask you about the. Well, actually, I should tell you. We'll probably start having a conversation if you're willing. And you know the program.
I thought we were having.
Oh well, we are. You're absolutely right. It's this stream of consciousness thing that we all do now. I wondered if you had anything to do with the cover of the Sugar Frosted Nutsack. I was just sitting here looking at it, and there are interesting things like the T is upside down in the. And the words "a novel" are backwards. Is that your choice?
No, I'm not sure if I received a couple of designs or if this was just the first one. I think the first one I saw probably lacked these beautiful little blue details.
Mm-hmm.
But the cover's interesting to me because it's grown on me terrifically. And it does have odd. It has its own little idiosyncrasies that you don't notice at first. But I can't take. I take credit for as much as possible. But I can't take credit for anything about this design. It's an extremely groovy book cover. It's very. I don't know. They're very op art, sort of psychedelic op art, immersive kind of vortex of an image here. I really love it.
Well, I was curious in part because I think it comments on the novel in some ways, that primarily that the words "a novel" are written backwards. In some ways, your novelistic career, if you will, has taken some odd backward turns. It's been, what, 14 years since your last novel?
Yes. Or that's what I'm told. It's a funny thing. The passage of time or how one experiences it, because as I said in... an interview I did recently with the New York Times Magazine. I came up with a very nice image for it, and I said to the writer, Adam Sternberg, that I felt as if I had paddled out on a boogie board into the ocean and fallen asleep. And when I woke up, an enormous amount of time had passed, and there was no one on the beach, and I sort of furiously paddled back, or maybe not so furiously. But it didn't, you know, this interregnum didn't feel, as I was experiencing it, like the sort of exile from prose fiction that it actually was, you know.
I'm curious, what were you doing all those years when you were out paddling on the boogie board?
Well, so part of the decision making about that was, part of it was aesthetic. I had written a series of books in to me what felt like a rapid succession. Maybe every 2 years, I came out with a book called My Cousin, My Gastroenterologist, and then A Two Babe, then a collection of shorter pieces that I had published in magazines. That was called Tooth Imprints on a Corn Dog, and then a novel called The Tetherballs of Bougainville. And it, at that point, it felt to me like I should stop for a little while.
Well, it's funny, in a way, because you were getting a lot of critical acclaim for the writing that you were doing. You were seen as one of the hot new stars of American fiction just when you when you stopped.
That's true. Again, this is something that has more clarity retrospectively. At the time, I really thought, okay, I felt like I had pursued certain problems, you know, certain issues, certain a set of certain problems and solutions in my work to an extent where I just wanted to take a break. I didn't want to feel like I was, you know, simply renewing my membership in the Writers Club of America with a book every couple of years, you know. And I think that was a very good decision. I mean, I feel about this whole long period of time that passed now that it was all exactly what was necessary to produce this book. That's the wonderful thing about how you can sort of sculpt time to suit your own psychological needs. But the other aspects of it were more practical. My wife and I had just had a daughter, and there were just some financial exigencies that didn't exist before. And I turned to script writing and script doctoring, as they call it, I think in the way that some writers turn to academia or journalism. You know, it just seemed a little more lucrative to me, and I had some interest in it. And I got involved in that, and over the years spent a lot of time crisscrossing back and forth from where I live, which is in Hoboken, New Jersey, which is right across the Hudson from Manhattan, and back and forth to Los Angeles, and writing scripts, and as I said, revising other scripts. And that sort of took the form of, you know, the sort of side, sort of moonlighting that writers do. But it was, I think, enough of a diversion and a distraction that I put aside any ideas I might have had about another novel. And a long period of time passed.
Well, I can imagine with all those long cross-country trips, you must have had time to do a lot of reading, too. There was also sometime during there a period, weren't you, you were in a car accident and had a period of convalescence?
I was in two car accidents. I was in a car accident in Sofia, Bulgaria, in which I was somehow amazingly unhurt because it was a pretty bad accident. And that was on the way to scout a location for a movie I had written, along with a writer named Jeremy Pixer, who wrote a movie called Bullworth, and with John Cusack. So I was in a car with some people scouting a location. But the more significant accident in terms of reading and sort of changing my stance about what to do next was in California, and I got hit by a car walking across the street. And as you said, there was a period of a couple of months convalescence where I was pretty much in bed. Walking around was difficult. And I started reading all the time and read all sorts of things. I'm almost hesitant to say what I read. It sounds like just a grad student's night table or something.
It's interesting, isn't it? I mean, part of it. I read an article that said during that time you read Moby Dick, for instance.
I read Moby Dick.
Now, anybody who has read The Sugar Frosted Nutsack would have a hard time I think, viewing you as a reader of Moby Dick. But
well,
maybe
the sugar frosted nut
wrong.
Sack is simply is the sugar frosted nut sack is simply Moby Dick run through the machinery of me.
Well, actually, this is it's a good transition because this isn't an easy question to ask any author any time, and it is especially difficult given some of the language in the sugar-frosted nutsack. We have the FCC to deal with, after all. Could you describe the plot of this novel?
I could describe a plot. But it wouldn't. It wouldn't even come close to really describing the experience of reading the book. So I think it's a great question. You know, a lot of this book involves a lot of the book involves simply analyzing and interpreting what the book is called. I mean, there's a lot of time spent on various titles. The book involves an epic. A supposed epic, which is called The Sugar-Frosted Nutsack, although there's a lot of scholarly controversy about what the real name is. I don't even think I can say what some of the names
some
were
of it,
that
I'm
were
certain
proposed
you can't
by,
say on the radio.
Right. There were many names proposed by scholars. And some of the plot of that aspect of the plot really was formed by a kind of interpenetration of my actual conversations about what to call the book with my editor. And, you know, some of the ideas I had for what the book should be called were deemed too profane to be of any use to the book company in placing the book in a store or advertising it in any way. So as I went, I had to change the title of the book, and that became an aspect of the plot of the book. What have scholars called this epic? Now, if we really want to be reductive about it, and which I'm happy to be, there's nothing wrong with being reductive. There is a man. He's an unemployed butcher. His name is Ike Carton. He lives in Jersey City, New Jersey, and Ike believes, rightly or wrongly, I don't want to spoil. I don't want to have to issue a spoiler alert here. But Ike believes that there is a pantheon of gods that determine what happens to mortals. There's some question raised in the book about whether these gods only exist in Ike's mind. There's also a kind of metaphysical proof, a kind of very logical proof posited by someone that, just because they exist, the fact that they may exist only in Ike's mind proves their existence. So there are all kinds of conversations about that. But really, in terms of what happens in the book, Ike goes to a diner and gets a tongue sandwich and flirts with the waitress, comes back, and then hangs out with his daughter's boyfriend, whose name is Vance, and basically waits to be killed. Ike has a kind of, I shouldn't say a fear. In a way, it's a hope, because Ike thinks that it's his destiny to be killed in front of his family and his neighbors, killed by Mossad, sharpshooters. So that's the great passion of Ike, is really to bring that destiny upon himself as quickly as possible.
I think that's actually a fairly concise reduction of the story that you're telling. And
it's very much the story, and not only is it the story, it's a story I reveal at the beginning of the book and sort of repeat and elaborate throughout the book, as myths can be. There's no one of the things I realized when I started this book is that there's no suspense about myths. We all know the endings to them. So I wanted to, I thought that there's something kind of wonderful about that, because it really confounds such a standard convention of novels, which is, reading in order to know what happens. In this book, we know what happens, and I'm constantly, in case you don't get it the first time,
you're making sure we know by the end.
I remind you, yes, ad nauseum.
Did you
what happens?
Did you bring a copy of the book with you?
Yes, I did.
Near the beginning of the book, where, as you say, you state much of this, page 5, I wonder if you would read that long paragraph on that page. It ends on the top of page 6. I think we can get away with that, and it'll give us a real flavor of the content.
Okay, let me find this.
It's page 5. It starts with these drunken
gods. I'm
going
to have to take these headphones off. So these drunken gods, hold on. I have just some logistical. If I could put these glasses on and keep these headphones on, that would be ideal. Okay. Well, you would like me to read these drunken gods up to what point?
Oh, up to the end of that paragraph, which is, it ends on the top of the next page as if they'd grown up together in the same small town. It'll be a couple of minutes, I think.
Okay, I got it. All right, I'm going to take these headphones off and read this, and then I will put them back on.
Good.
How's that sound?
Sounds terrific.
All right. These drunken gods had been driven by bus to a place they did not recognize. It's almost as if they'd been on some sort of spring break, as if they'd gone wild. At first, they were like frozen aphids. They were so out of it, as if in a state of suspended animation. It took them several more million years just to come to sort of thaw out. The first god to emerge momentarily from the bus was called El Brazo, the arm, also known as Das Unheimlichste des Amheimlichen, the strangest of the strange. He was bare-chested and wore white Columbia blue polyester dazzle basketball shorts. He would soon be worshipped as the god of virility, the god of urology, the god of pornography, etc. El Brazo leaned out of the bus and struck a contrapposto pose, his head turned away from the torso, an image endlessly reproduced in paintings, sculptures, temple carvings, coins, maritime flags, postage stamps, movie studio logos, souvenir snow globes, takeout coffee cups, playing cards, cigarette packs, condom wrappers, etc. His pomaded hair swept back into a frothy nape of curls like the wake of a speedboat. He reconnoitered the void with an impassive take-it-or-leave-it gaze, then scowled dyspeptically, immediately turned around and returned to the bus, where he suddenly ensconced himself, along with the rest of the gods, for another 1.6 million years. It's extraordinary that among these sulking, hungover deities who chose to forever doze and fidget in a bus, there were several with enough joie de vivre to continue beatboxing that hypnotic riff for an eternity, that music that's been so persistently likened to a dance mix of the Mr. Softy jingle. Perhaps it was a fragment of their alma mater's fight song. They did act, after all, like classmates, as if they'd grown up together in the same small town. I'm back.
That was very nicely done. Thank you. And I think that does give us a very clear idea of at least how one page of the Sugar Frosted Nutsack goes. These gods are, if they only exist in Ike's head, there's a lot of fascinating imagination in his head, isn't there?
Well, yes, I was going to say thank you, but you're praising Ike's head, not mine, which even better.
Yeah.
when I originally started toying around with this idea of gods and goddesses, I very much adamantly did not want to do anything that was like a parody, you know, of Greek gods and goddesses or Norse gods or Hindu gods. I wanted to create a completely unprecedented group of gods and goddesses. So I think you know, that procedure had some pretty interesting results and consequences.
Yeah. Well, we've met El Brazzo in the reading that you did. Tell me about, do you say Exo, Exo, one of the central gods?
Yes. I have to say, I'm particularly proud of Exo, Exo as a character. I would say he may be the surpassing creation of mine over all these years, because XOXO in a way represents the nemesis of all writers. I think I originally talk about, in the book, I originally talk about XOXO as the god of head trauma and concussions and amnesia. But then I distill XOXO's function down to really being the great opponent, the great enemy of the epic. XOXO changes the epic. In a sense, I have to battle XOXO to complete this book. And XOXO is a mischievous god and puts things in the book that I didn't intend to be in the book, takes things out that I wanted in the book. As I was creating this character, I realized it's the most brilliant thing a writer could have, because I can simply blame anything on XOXO. if someone says, I love the book, but I didn't like this part, I'd say, well, of course not. That's an interpolation of XOXO's. I had nothing to do with that. I agree with you.
I was going to say that I thought maybe XOXO was the dark side of your muse, but the way you describe him, maybe he's the light side.
Well, as is obvious, and as I discuss at various points in the book, especially towards the end. I mean, one's nemesis becomes one's most cherished collaborator in many walks of life, you know. So that's certainly the case here. So, yeah, I would say XOXO is brethren in some way or another.
You may be a man who has recently read Thomas Hardy and Herman Melville, but clearly you also spend a good deal of time with other kinds of writing. There's a section in The Sugar Frosted Nutsack that includes a whole page or two or three of internet exchanges, including a lot of abbreviations that I would need an internet dictionary, I think, to understand.
Well, perhaps or perhaps not. I'm sure I made some up. But I wanted to, you know, My practical philosophy about how to go about making these books is to use everything and everything and anything. I happen to be reading recently. I read a great biography of Claude Lévi-Strauss, so I'll use a Lévi-Straussian term. But Lévi-Strauss used this term bricolage, which describes a kind of handyman activity, using what's at hand to make everything and anything that you might need. And that's sort of my methodology, too. Some of these things I'm not as facile and comfortable with as younger people. So some of this involved dipping my foot into waters that I ordinarily don't. But I had a lot of fun with those sorts of forms, and I use at various times a kind of form used in celebrity tabloid magazines, you know, well, these sentences that are very sort of breathless exclamations rather than sentences that I use, you know, that rather than the sort of more lyrical kinds of things that I tend to use.
But this may explain why sometimes I felt as though you were writing, I hesitate to say this, but I will. You were writing whatever came into your head.
I've heard that before. Well, I have. If that's what results, it's the most tortured stream of consciousness ever in the history of streams or consciousness. No, it's very. It's a very meticulous workmanlike procedure, so almost grimly so, to end up with this result. But I do think one of the things I wanted this book to have is a kind of subjectivity of its own. It's almost as if the book is the mind creating itself. And you can watch. It's like one of those machines that without any membrane over it, so you can see all its inner workings. I think it's very easy to read, as you're reading this book, see how the book is almost creating itself from page to page. There's a kind of transparency about it in that way that I like very much.
Some of the comment on the book has suggested that your fiction is surreal. Would you use that word? Do you consider what you're doing to be in the tradition of surrealism?
You know, it's very interesting. I probably over the years I wouldn't, except that over the past couple of months, actually since I finished this book, I've become fascinated and very admiring of André Breton, who was the great magnificent, some called him the Pope of Surrealism. And the more I read about the more of the sort of surrealist polemics I read, the more affinity I feel with them. So I would say I don't really think along the way I've been influenced by surrealist writing per se, but in a kind of retrospective way, I feel a kinship with the surrealists. I mean, who really were most active quite a long time ago in the 20s and 30s.
Although I've read somewhere that you've set a great example of American surrealism is Chuck Jones, who did the classic Bugs Bunny cartoon.
Yeah, I think so. When I think about, if you think about the sensibility of a writer, an artist, or of anyone, I think it's probably determined much earlier on than that person's actual entrance into the whatever art form they eventually become known for. So I was thinking, I've thought over the years, what were those things that kind of opened you up to the possibilities of narrative forms encompassing the sort of wild miscellany of things that I like to work with?
A lot of novelists wouldn't want Bugs Bunny to be recited as one of their influences.
Yeah,
but I can see there's a
It's honest.
Of,
I mean, yeah. it's honest. I think, you know, I think it would be disingenuous for me to say that at a certain age I was sitting there in bed with a flashlight, you know, reading Heidegger. Although I have spent some time recently under the covers with a flashlight reading Heidegger. There's some fabulous stuff. There's a great period of American animation, and it's a rich trove of stuff. The Fleischer brothers who did Betty Boop and the early Popeye cartoons and Chuck Jones. I mean, if you watch a classic Chuck Jones Warner Brothers cartoon, there really is a kind of multi-dimensionality about the narratives. It's very striking. I mean,
is that similar to the multidimensional narrative in the Sugar Frosted Nutsack? Is that what the?
I would say, yeah. I mean, this is certainly not. Again, I'm not. It would really be inaccurate to point to just Chuck Jones. I mean, I think I've lived through so many influences and was very much influenced by painting at a certain time in my life, by discovering Jackson Pollock, for instance, who remains a great aesthetic hero of mine. But all kinds of things and certain kinds of music, and I think in a sense I was much more. I think what inspired me to be so stubbornly adventurous about form were probably media outside of literature, so probably painting and music and film a little bit more than other books and other writers.
You've also said somewhere that you think of the world as a cryptogram. Is that true? What do you mean by that, if it's true?
I really love thinking of the world as rampant with sort of signs to be that
clues
and symbols and signs that wait to be interpreted. You know, I think the world exists as a kind of source of exegesis. You know, and I was reading some book maybe a year or two ago, and it had to do with, I think, the Sicilian Cosa Nostra. And there was a prosecutor in this case, and he said the loveliest thing, which is that it is the vocation of a gentleman to interpret signs. And it certainly is my vocation to create a world that is sizzling and pulsing with signs to be interpreted. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's not a bad description of what I'm trying to do.
One of the blurbs on the back cover of your novel talks about shattering synapses and scrambling brains. I'm curious.
It's very violent. Sounds violent.
It does. I mean, it makes you wonder, what are you, besides delighting your readers, is there anything particular you're trying to do to our brains?
Well, I hope that the experience of reading my work, at least for that time, I don't know if the effect is permanent or damaging beyond the actual real time experience of the book, but it's to have a kind of extremely sort of hyper vivid, unmediated experience of language, and I think. And as a corollary of the world, of one's world, somewhat transformed and transformative way. You know, I think for the cumulative hours that it takes to read the Sugar Frosted Nutsack, I hope that it provides for the reader, as I said, intensely unmediated experience of what language can do. That's unlike anything the reader will have encountered before.
So I have to ask, it's been 14 years since the last one. Is it going to be 14 years till the next one? And if not, what else are you going to do?
I think I'm planning on this time a 28-year hiatus. That would make me no. I am working away. I have an enormous folder. I don't even at this point. It's so bulging with notes, and I can't exactly tell you. Not somewhat out of being secretive, and sort of hermetic about these things. But I can't really say what it's about quite yet. Also, I'm not certain. The 14-year. A gestation period of this book was required because at this point in my life, I really need some sort of crisis, some sort of rupture that I'm feeling that drives me, that gives me a sort of urgency about doing what I'm doing. And it can be, as I've, to use a word I've used over the past half hour or so, a kind of aesthetic crisis or a kind of personal crisis. I think what makes the Sugar Frosted Nutsack feel like a kind of, what gives it a kind of sense of pulsing urgency is that this book involves a kind of personal crisis and a kind of aesthetic crisis that are intertwined, that are interpenetrating. So, you know, I sometimes have to force myself into a corner, into a kind of impasse, and then the book is the result of my finding my way out of it. So I will have some desperate crisis soon, and there'll be a book sooner than later.
Well, I'm not sure I've ever said this to anyone before, but here's wishing you another crisis.
Thank you. That's very sweet of you to say.
And thank you for talking with us.
Great to talk to you.
All right. Thank you very much. That was good.
Thank you very much. It's great to talk to you again.
Yeah.
And if I'm out in your neck of the woods, maybe we'll see.
Oh, come by.
See each other. Okay.
That'd be nice. Thanks a lot.
All right. Take care.